11.
Pete Williams, Clapper echoed distantly, chewing determinedly away at his double-portion haddock and chips lunch, periodically washing it down with a swallow of non-alcoholic ginger beer. He's a writer who got into a hassle with Edgar Villarreal the last time the consortium met, 2 years ago. And who's Edgar Villarreal? Clapper asked without much interest, using his knife to plaster the last of the mushy peas onto his fork. Sergeant Clapper ate in what Gideon thought of as the classic English manner, holding his knife like a scalpel to cut things, so elegant, and then employing it to lather stuff on the back of his fork, which was then stuck in his mouth upside down, so inelegant. And since the English rarely put down either implement during a meal, when they chewed, it was impossible not to think of Oliver Twist sitting over his paltry meal in the workhouse, holding his knife and fork upright on the table. On the other hand, Gideon was ready to admit, Americans wasted a lot of motion changing hands twice every time they had to cut a piece of meat. Gideon explained about Villarreal as he continued to work on his plowman's lunch of cheddar cheese, half a baguette, relish, pickle as they called it, pickled onion, and a bit of lettuce and tomato salad. He was a relatively fast eater, always finishing before Julie, but Clapper put him to shame.
And he actually threatened to kill him, Clapper asked as Gideon finished the story. With witnesses?
No, I wouldn't call it a threat, and he didn't say it to the guy's face. He was with some of the other members right here at the Bishop and Wolf and muttering in his beer. Gideon lifted his own half-pint of bitter and sipped, and said he'd like to kill him, which, I agree, wouldn't ordinarily mean much of anything, but Williams seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth since then, so I thought it was worth mentioning to you. You might want to see what you can find out about him.
Clapper laughed. All right, give me 15 minutes and I'll have it done.
I gather there's a problem. I mean, I know it must be a fairly common name.
Fairly common. Gideon. Williams is the third most common name in Great Britain, followed closely on the heels of Smith and Jones. And if I'm not mistaken, Peter comes right after William and John as a Christian name. Still, I thought you'd want...
I do, of course I do.
But I'd have appreciated it if you could have come up with a more unusual name.
He hauled out a notepad.
Where is he supposed to live?
I think somebody said London.
Naturally, Clapper said wryly. And he's a writer, you say?
Well, not really. I gather this was his first book. He snapped his fingers as the previous night's conversation at the Bishop and Wolf came back to him.
He was an auto mechanic. He worked in a garage. That should make it easier, shouldn't it?
Yes, that's excellent, Clapper said, yawning.
He entered a final scribble in his notepad, reached for a menu, and pulled it to him.
Now then, fancy a spot of pudding. Let me recommend...
Bloody hell, that's mine.
His cell phone had signaled. It was stowed in the pocket of his top coat, which hung from a coat rack, its hem trailing on the floor, so he had to unwedge himself from behind the table and get up to answer it.
Is that so? Well, I'll let you tell him yourself.
He handed the phone to Gideon.
Kyle.
Dr. Oliver, Rob piped happily. I don't like to interrupt your lunch, but we found some more. Only about a foot down. Appear to be hand or foot bones. I'm not sure which. Maybe both. Those little finger bones.
Phalanges.
And then some of the funny-shaped little ones you mentioned. And also the bottoms. I mean the distal ends of the tibias, or maybe it's the, ulnas, depending.
That's great, Kyle. Okay, we'll be right there.
Clapper took back his phone, clicked it shut, and cast a last wistful look at the menu.
So much for puddin', he said.
The new hoard that Tess had uncovered, now resting on the length of screening, did indeed consist of a mix of left and right hand and foot bones, plus the distal ends of both tibias, one fibula, and one ulna.
I count 35 hand and foot bones altogether, Gideon said, kneeling over them, Are you pretty sure you got them all? Could any of them have migrated a few feet one way or the other, beyond where you looked?
Not according to Tess, said Hicks.
He was sitting on the sand, elbows around drawn-up knees, smoking his pipe. Tess sat beside him, watching with polite interest.
I dug up a pretty big area, Rob said uncertainly. How many should be there?
27 in the hand, 26 in the foot. And parts of both hands and feet are here, so that would be a total of, 106,
Clapper promptly supplied.
The rest have probably been washed away, Hicks offered. Or possibly the shrews got them, or the crabs.
Or the seals, said Gideon, or the crows, or the gulls, or other people's pet dogs. Well, it's not a bad haul, considering.
He got to his feet and brushed off the knees of his trousers.
If Tess is finished, then I'd like to have a chance to look it all over in detail. Mike, you said you had some place for me to work?
Actually, the final quadrant hasn't been searched, Hicks said, unwrapping one arm from his knee to point to the rock-littered upslope at the far end of the beach.
Gideon followed his gesture.
That's pretty unlikely to turn up anything, Mr. Hicks. Too many rocks, too much brush. People digging holes for dead bodies prefer easier terrain.
Yes, that was my thinking. That's why I left it for last, in case we couldn't get to it. Poor Tess is thoroughly knackered at the moment, I'm afraid.
He massaged the ruff of her neck.
And I'm feeling my age as well. I think we'll pack it in. Maybe we'll try again tomorrow.
Clapper shook his head.
That's doubtful, Truss. If the fog gets much worse, which I don't doubt it will, even Ron won't be able to get you here tomorrow.
Hicks got creakily to his feet.
Well, we'll see, shall we? He paused. I don't suppose the Devon and Cornwall Constabulary would have it in them to buy a hungry old man his pottage, now would they?
Absolutely, Clapper said. I apologize, Truss, I wasn't thinking. You must be starving. You too, Kyle. Kyle, I want you to take Mr. Hicks to any dining establishment of his choice, courtesy of the department, and give him a truly memorable lunch. Anything he wants, and remember, expense is not a consideration.
Why, thank you, Michael, Hicks said. I'm quite touched.
Anything up to and including a pound, Clapper said grandly. Will this give you enough room, then? Clapper asked.
They had just finished arranging the unoccupied cubicle opposite Rob's office, clearing the desk of storage files and assorted debris, and shoving the stacks that were on the floor up against the walls to provide more room around the desk.
It'll do fine, Gideon said, placing the sacks of bones on the desk. We can put the coffee maker elsewhere if you want. No, leave it on the desk, it won't bother me. I wouldn't recommend drinking any, however, at least not in the afternoon after it's been out a while. Takes a bit of getting used to. Mike, Gideon said, laughing, stale coffee and bone dust go together like bees and honey. Don't worry about me. Very well, then. Anything you need to get you started?
Yes, a magnifying glass. And I need something to measure with, a ruler, a tape measure, too, if you have one. Calipers would be too much to hope for, I assume.
They would indeed.
Gideon blinked up at the fluorescent tubes overhead.
And an adjustable desk lamp, if there is one, something to counter the flat lighting.
Clapper nodded, moving toward the doorless entry of the tiny cubicle.
Oh, and where's the tibial fragment I brought over on Monday? Is it in here someplace? No, it's still in my office. I'll bring it.
While he was gone, Gideon sat down, opened the bags, and began arranging the bones, sorting left from right, and placing them roughly in their anatomical relationships. When Clapper returned, Gideon took the partial left tibia, the upper four-fifths of the bone, from him, and set it against the partial left tibia, the lower portion, that they'd found today. Carefully, he set cut end to cut end. As he then demonstrated, they fit together so perfectly that, kept upright, they didn't have to be held in place.
There you go, he said with satisfaction. Couldn't be a neater fit, could it? You can even see how the breakaway spur from the one from the museum
fits right into that little cleft in the new one. These are from the same person, absolutely no question about it.
Well, that's a relief, isn't it?
Clapper lazily poured a splash of coffee into a mug that he took from a pegboard on the wall and sat down across the desk from Gideon.
I'd hate to think there was a whole series of dismembered corpses littering our pristine beaches.
Are you saying you definitely agree that that's what we're dealing with, a dismembered corpse? You're convinced?
Clapper stared at him.
Well, of course I am. What else would I think?
I just wanted to be sure. You never said so in so many words, and you sure weren't that convinced a couple of days ago.
A couple of days ago, there was one measly piece of bone, species and context unverified, brought in unannounced by a man who claimed to be some sort of anthropologist. But now, he gestured at the array on the table,
does this mean you'll be turning the case over to headquarters?
Not bloody likely,
Clapper burst out, then collected himself. That is to say, he said serenely, not at the present time.
Let us first see what results ensue from the pursuit of our inquiries.
That suited Gideon, who was getting to enjoy working with Clapper.
Fine, let us begin pursuing them.
He glanced over the 30-odd hand and foot bones. No obvious age or sex differences, and no duplication, he said. And everything matches the original tibia in condition and general appearance. No reason to think there's more than one person here.
I thought we'd just establish that.
Yes, but it's the kind of thing you like to establish more than once.
With a goose-necked lamp that Clapper had brought now on the desk, casting its light sideways to accentuate textures, he turned the bird-like bones, one at a time, this way and that, for their first examination.
No obvious trauma or pathologies.
Well, except for a little osteoarthritis in some of the joints.
That probably puts the age, up in the 30s or 40s at any rate.
Clapper, in the act of lighting a cigarette, looked up from under his eyebrows.
30 or 40 years old, and the poor bugger already has arthritis.
Sure, so do I. So do you.
Get away. My joints are perfectly fine.
He waved his arms in circles to prove it.
I'm in my prime, couldn't be primer.
Mike, I hate to tell you this, but you're not in your prime. You never were. Your bones get stronger and healthier as they grow, say to 25 or so, 30 at the outside. And then, wham, it's downhill from there right up to the end. The minute they reach maturity, they turn around and start deteriorating. Osteoarthritis, atrophy, osteoporosis. There is no prime, as far as your skeleton goes. Or if there is, it lasts about 5 minutes, and the chances are you were doing something else at the time and you missed it.
Clapper blew out his first lungful of smoke.
Now there's a charming thought.
And as for the rest of you, it doesn't last all that much longer. You know those free radicals and antioxidants that start building up as you get older? Those are just your body's way of trying to get rid of you. Nature doesn't want you hanging around using up resources any longer than necessary, which means just long enough to get your DNA into the gene pool so the human race keeps going. So it does what it can to keep you healthy till then. After that, you're on your own. If you're not contributing any more DNA to the species, the hell with you. The sooner you're out of the picture, the better,
he laughed.
Hey, have another puff. Mother Nature will appreciate it.
Clapper scowled at him, but he was amused.
Oh, I can see I'm going to enjoy hanging out with you.
He looked for an ashtray, but didn't find one.
Try and carry on without me for a minute, will you?
He went to his office in search of an ashtray and came back with a metal one, logoed The Goat and Compass, Norwich.
Well now, here's something, Gideon said as Clapper sat down, the ashtray in his lap.
With his thumb, Gideon was stroking a smooth, dime-sized area on the lower margin of the right tibia, the part that connects to the ankle.
You don't see these very often in modern skeletons, other than Asians.
Clapper peered at this spot, but obviously saw nothing. Still, he was interested.
You're saying this bloke is from Asia? You can tell that from that little spot.
No, I'm not saying that at all. Well, not necessarily. You see, I'm fairly sure it's a squatting facet, though admittedly not a very distinct one. Asians have them more frequently than other people because squatting is more common in the East, Clapper supplied.
Right. Gideon checked the other tibia. Yes, this one has it too. I'd feel more confident about there definitely being squatting facets if we had a talus, the ankle bone just below this one. Because then we'd look for a matching facet on the medial portion of the trochlear surface, where the two bones abut. But as you see, we don't have a talus.
Pity that, said Clapper.
But assuming that you're correct, and that these are indeed squatting facets, what is there to be made of them?
Gideon put the tibias down.
Well, that at some point in his life this guy did a lot of squatting. Squatting requires dorsiflexion of the foot, he demonstrated with his hand, laying it flat on the table, palm down, then raising it with a sharp bend of the wrist.
And habitual dorsiflexion results in bone remodeling that produces squatting facets, like these.
I see, Clapper said dryly, emitting twin plumes of smoke from his nostrils. You're telling me that we're dealing with a habitual squatter here, a serial squatter, as it were.
It was the kind of labored drollery that would have annoyed Gideon 2 days ago, coming from the newly met Sergeant Clapper. But now he knew Clapper better, and he laughed.
All I can tell you is what I find. This guy had some kind of occupation or hobby, or maybe a cultural upbringing, that involved a whole lot of squatting. If it helps identify him, great. If not, I can't help that.
Couldn't just be someone who spent a lot of time in the loo, could it?
Gideon said abstractly. He had gotten out of his chair and picked up the ulna now, the larger of the two forearm bones, and was slowly running his fingertips down it with his eyes closed. Like most anthropologists, he relied on his fingers almost as much as his eyes. It was touch, along with sight, that revealed the unobtrusive little ridges and facets and depressions that could tell the story of a lifetime, as well as the nicks and notches and cracks that might well throw light on the last few seconds of it. In this case, it was a ridge that had captured his interest, a small, sharp ridge near the top of the ulna, the larger of the two forearm bones, that ran diagonally, front to back, for not much more than an inch, a little below the elbow joint. First his middle finger and then his thumb slid lightly over it.
This is a supinator crest, he said after a very long silence, during which Clapper had sighed and yawned, and finally gathered himself up in preparation to leave.
Oh, yes, Clapper replied politely, part way out of his chair.
Yes, murmured Gideon, who at this point wasn't paying any more attention to Clapper than Clapper was paying to him. Everyone has it, but this particular one is extremely well developed. He was, in effect, talking to himself, something he was prone to doing when looking at bones. Julie accused him of talking to them, but it was himself he was addressing. He was firm about that.
Now, the supinator crest, he continued, naturally is the origin of the supinator muscle, or at least of the deep layer of it.
Naturally?
Which is the primary muscle involved in supination.
Well, I could have told you that.
Of the hand, especially when the arm is in an extended position. Now that is interesting.
Clapper, who'd remained half in, half out of his chair, dropped down again.
Maybe you'd better run through that again. What's interesting?
Well, supination.
Aware that Clapper, like most people, might be a little hazy about the term, again used his own hand to illustrate, once more placing it palm down on the table, but this time flipping it over sideways with a twist of his forearm, so it rested on its back.
That's supination of the hand.
Like turning a doorknob, he almost said, before remembering that doorknobs were few and far between in Europe, where handles were preferred. And turning a door handle, pressing it down really, mostly involved the muscles of the upper arm and shoulder. Clapper shook his head, puzzled.
So?
So whoever owned this bone did a great deal of just that movement, only with some stress associated with it. And it occurs to me, now this is just a shot in the dark with nothing solid to go on, you understand. I'm not asserting anything, I'm not even hypothesizing, really.
I imagine, Clapper mused to the walls, that if I sit here long enough, eventually he'll come round to telling me what it is that's occurred to him. Well, only that supination, he turned his hand over again, is the motion that's involved in using a screwdriver, or to some extent in screwing on a radiator cap, or battery cap, or in, Clapper said, catching on, all manner of tasks having to do with maintaining motor cars. Thoughtfully, he picked a shred of tobacco from his tongue.
You really believe, then, that this might be our automobile mechanic Pete Williams? That Villarreal actually murdered him over some silly academic dispute?
Well, I'm not about to go that far, Gideon said. For all we know, he's still happily walking around London and working on his book at night. So let's find that out first, but right now, he repeated what Liz had said to him at the Bishop and Wolf the previous night, we sure don't have any other hypotheses to go on.
Clapper pondered this, taking a last drag on his cigarette, grinding it out, and then nodding while smoke poured from mouth and nostrils.
But where would the squatting facets come in?
Gideon shrugged.
Auto mechanics spend a lot of time hunkering down to look at the undersides of cars and at the wheels and things, don't they?
I really wouldn't know.
I wouldn't either. Either way, though, they could come from something unrelated to what he did for a living.
Hmm, said Clapper. Well, it's something to look into. I'll see what can be found out about Mr. Williams's current existence or lack thereof. And what about this Edgar Villarreal? Where would we be likely to find him?
Not in this world, it seems, Gideon said and explained.
Eaten by a bear, Clapper said with a grimace.
But at that point they were interrupted by the laughing entrance of Kyle Robb, who burst in triumphantly, cradling two large paper sacks in the crooks of his arms.
Mr. Hicks was much revived by lunch, as was Tess, and they decided to finish up that last quadrant today after all. And look what the good little doggie has turned up.
Two more caches, Gideon asked. I wasn't really expecting any, not from there.
Only one, Robb said, placing the bags on the desk. But it's a big one. Couldn't fit it in one sack.
He stepped back.
Have a look, why don't you?
Gideon tore the sacks down their sides and gently spread out their contents. These are the bones of the thorax, the upper body. And a lot of it is here, Kyle. Scapulas, clavicles, vertebrae, ribs. The top parts of the humeri, too. There's plenty to work with. This ought to tell us a lot.
I thought you'd be pleased, Robb said, as proud of himself as if he'd personally nosed them out. I've cleaned them up a bit for you.
Thank you. I'll pick up, lad, Clapper said when the telephone rang, and went into Rob's cubicle to do it.
Presented with all these unexpected bones, Gideon felt like Silas Marner viewing his hoard. He practically wanted to rub his hands together.
First, he told an observant Robb, we'll want to... It's for you, Clapper called, holding out the receiver.
Mumbling something, Gideon wandered abstractedly into the other cubicle and took the phone. Julie was on the other end.
Hi, it's me.
Hi, sweetheart.
She laughed.
I see the expedition was successful. You found some bones, didn't you?
What? Yes, how did you know?
Well, partly because you were there in the police station and you said that's where you'd be if you found something to work on. But mostly because you sound like your mind's about a million miles away, and that's the way you sound when you're deep in bones.
Yes, well, as a matter of fact...
Gideon, you didn't forget about the picnic, did you?
Picnic?
He heard a small sigh.
Madeline Goodfellow invited us all to a picnic reception and dinner on Holgate's Green. You do remember that, don't you?
Of course I do,
said Gideon affrontedly. "Geez, Julie, I'm not that absent-minded." Indeed, he did seem to have a vague memory to that effect.
"Yes," she said dryly, and he knew that she was smiling. "Of course you do. Only it's not on the green, it's too foggy. It's indoors at the museum. That's where I'm calling from. It started half an hour ago. You are coming, aren't you?"
"Well, sure, I am. The time just got a little away from me, that's all."
He cast a last, long, lingering look at the bones in the cubicle opposite.
"See you in 15 minutes. As Clapper had predicted, the fog had continued to thicken, swirling in tendrils of graveyard gray, like mist on a stage set. Walking from the police station to the museum, he could actually see it part in front of him, like water before the prow of a ship, and then close again behind him.
"I haven't seen muck like this in donkey's years,"
he heard one dimly seen passerby complain to another. It was only a little after 6, 3 hours until dark, but the store windows were already lit and the streetlights were on, although they did little but contribute an occasional sickly, sulphurous yellow nimbus to the all-enveloping gray goop. Even the footsteps of others and the occasional whispered snatches of conversation he heard were dulled and muffled by the atmosphere.
"This is cool. It really creeps you out,"
the distorted voice of an invisible child exulted. With only 6 feet or so of visibility, it was easy to imagine oneself back 100 years, on some gloomy, fog-swirling London street, with cut purses and body snatchers lurking in the alleys, and street girls and fishmongers hawking their goods on the sidewalks. At the thought, he laughed aloud, no doubt startling anyone within range. The thing was, there was surely only one person you could reasonably call a body snatcher in Hughtown at this moment, and his name was Gideon Oliver. As for fishmongers, there actually was one, or rather a fish and chips van, customerless and forlorn, parked near the town hall, barely visible in the blurry glow of its single light bulb. As he left the town center, the lights grew fewer and the illusion of Victorian times more pervasive. So much so that when the van, now a block behind him, gave up for the day and banged its shutters closed, he took the noise at first for the clop of horses' hooves. He pulled his jacket closer around him. Although his collar was turned up, his neck was wet with moisture that ran down from his hair. Absently, he touched the facade of one of the 17th-century buildings. He had the unconscious habit of grazing his fingers along ancient buildings as he went by them on old streets. For the anthropologist in him, it was a small, nurturing point of contact with the past. But this time, he jerked his hand back. The rough-cut stones were as slimy as eels. He shivered. "I'm getting a little creeped out myself," he thought, looking forward to the dinner now. It was going to be good to talk about something other than homicide and body parts. He would listen without a peep of dissent, even to Victor's twaddle about Western thought-dominated, non-relational ways of being. Alas, it was not to be.